Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Anthony Arend, Professor of Government and Foreign Service, and a Senior Associate Dean for Graduate and Faculty Affairs in the Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. He'll speak on the topic North Korea and the Preemptive Use of Force. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday afternoon, September 8, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Mike Kelly, Interim Dean of the Creighton University School of Law.
Anthony Clark Arend is Professor of Government and Foreign Service at Georgetown University. In 2015, he became Senior Associate Dean for Graduate and Faculty Affairs in the Walsh School of Foreign Service. He's also director of the Master of Science in Foreign Service program. With Professor Christopher Joyner, he founded the Institute for International Law and Politics at Georgetown and served as co-director of that institute from 2003 to 2008. He has also served as an adjunct professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center. Prior to coming to Georgetown, he was a senior fellow at the Center for National Security Law at the University of Virginia School of Law. He's also served as an editor in the Virginia Journal of International Law. Dr. Arend's teaching interests are in the areas of international law, international organization, international relations, international legal philosophy, yes, that's a thing, and constitutional law of the United States foreign relations. Dr. Arend is a life member of the Council on Foreign Relations, no small achievement, I might add, and serves as a senator on the Board of Governors of the Georgetown University Alumni Association. Welcome, Professor Arend.
Thank you very much, Mike. Okay, I am wired, literally, and perhaps figuratively as well, for those who know me. So that may make my voice a little bit louder than it normally is, and it's normally pretty loud. So I want to thank Mike very much for hosting me here at Creighton. I want to thank Dave for all your great work in organizing this particular talk on such short notice. And I want to thank Kim Jong-un for facilitating the topic of this particular talk. Now, what is really sad is that I was originally asked to come and give a talk at StratCom on North Korea and the preemptive use of military force several months ago. And it was relevant then, but what we didn't realize is that it would become increasingly relevant as time passed by. So we're confronted with a rather serious problem, one that perhaps rocks our understanding of international relations. And I've posed the question, a preemptive strike against North Korea. It is something that we have heard intimated in the press, comments made by the Secretary of Defense, and even the President of the United States imply that it might very well be something that is forthcoming. Now, there are any number of ways to analyze a preemptive use of military force. We are here at Creighton, a Jesuit institution, and as I look back on the wall, I see a quote from Micah, chapter 6, verse 8, "Do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God." And there are many in this room who remember that Jimmy Carter quoted that in his inaugural address when he became president of the United States. I note that because there is an ethical way of analyzing this question too. Different ethical norms, different ethical approaches, which will give us some guidance about whether it makes sense to launch a preemptive strike against North Korea. That's one form of analysis. Another form of analysis would be to look at it from a policy perspective. What will be the policy consequences of a preemptive strike against North Korea? What would this mean for the international community? What would it mean within the United States? What would it mean within the world at large? Those are all important ways to analyze this question. I want to focus on one other way, and that is to look at the legality of a strike against North Korea under international law. That's not to say it's ethical. That's not to say it makes policy sense. But here we are in a law school talking about legal aspects. What does international law tell us about whether it be permissible to launch a preemptive strike against North Korea? Now, in order to examine this, we're going to look at four things. First of all, I want to talk very briefly, because I teach a whole course on this, on the sources of international law. How is international law created? Where does it come from? Secondly, I want to look at the United Nations Charter framework for the recourse to force. The UN Charter sets forth certain legal rules about when it is permissible for states and other actors to use force. So what are those rules? Then I want to look at the legal debate about the preemptive use of force in self-defense. If it were easy, there wouldn't be a debate, but there is a debate about this issue. And then finally, I want to see how we can apply some of these legal principles to the North Korean case. So that's what I propose to do. Let's start. International law. How is international law created? Now, I will not play my law professor role and start asking people questions in this room about that, but I will answer that question. In the international community, international law is created in a decentralized fashion by states. There's no central authority that makes the law. The UN doesn't make law as we understand it. Rather, we have a decentralized system consisting of about 200 independent sovereign states. The states themselves create the law in a decentralized fashion, in a decentralized manner. How do they do this? Two primary ways: through treaties and through custom. Now, and they're both important to understand this, because we start to look at the North Korean case, unless we understand those two different ways in which states create international law, we'll miss some things. So, treaties. Treaties are kind of easy for everybody to understand. They are the international equivalent of contracts. Just as a contract is binding on the parties to the contract, so too the treaty is binding on the parties to the treaty. Now, treaties can be bilateral between two states or multilateral among many states. The United Nations Charter, which I'm going to talk about in a little bit, is a multilateral treaty with 193 parties. So it is a multilateral treaty. So states create law through treaties. Makes sense, obvious, probably everybody would figure that one out. But there is another way in which states create international law, and that is through custom, what is called customary international law. Now, it's important that we get an understanding of this because it's not necessarily intuitive. The logic of customary international law is that states create law not by what they put down in writing in a treaty, but by what they do in practice. The idea of customary international law is a state begins engaging in some kind of activity. Time passes. More and more states start engaging in that activity. More time passes. More and more states start engaging in that activity until you have virtually a universalized practice. Virtually all the states in the international system are engaging in that activity. Then, at some point in time, those states that had begun engaging in that activity begin to perceive the activity to be obligatory, to be required by law. That's when we say we have a rule of customary international law. Now, I'm going to give you a really silly example. Let us say that a state decides it wants to do this. Okay? Why? For fun. For purely pragmatic, for purely practical reasons, a state wants to do this. Okay? Other states say, you know what? We want to do it too. More states start saying, yeah, we want to do it as well. More and more states start doing it. Why? Purely pragmatic, practical reasons. Until you reach a point where virtually all states in the international system are engaging in this activity. Then states begin to perceive that activity to be obligatory, to be required by law. Let me give you a real-world example that doesn't involve me jumping around. Diplomatic immunity. Diplomatic immunity, the idea that the host state could not exercise criminal enforcement jurisdiction over a diplomat from another state. That wasn't suddenly established as a rule of law. It started for practical, pragmatic reasons. I won't arrest your diplomats, so you don't arrest my diplomats. I won't shoot your diplomats, so you won't shoot my diplomats. In order for us to maintain communication, we need for diplomats to be immune from criminal enforcement jurisdiction. That started for those practical, pragmatic reasons. As time progressed, more states in the system started engaging in that activity. They said, yeah, it makes sense. More time passed. You had a universalized practice. Pretty much all states in the system were granting diplomatic immunity. Then those states began to perceive, this is legally required. We may have started for practical, pragmatic reasons, but we now believe it is legally required. We believe it is now an obligation, a legal obligation, for us to grant diplomatic immunity. So you see the idea. Now I'm spending a lot of time talking about customary law, because in order to understand the North Korean case, we're going to need to understand it. Bottom line here is states create law two ways, through treaties, written agreements, and through custom, with the idea that custom is a practice that becomes universalized and then is then accepted as law, is believed by states to create a binding legal obligation. International law has equal validity whether it is created by a treaty or through custom. That's important. International law has equal validity whether it is created by a treaty or through custom. Okay. Now we know a little bit about what international law is. What is international law dealing with the use of military force? We're going to start with a treaty, the United Nations Charter. The United Nations Charter is a multilateral treaty, as I noted a few minutes ago, ratified by 193 states. It is a multilateral treaty. Among the things the UN Charter sets forth are provisions relating to the use of military force. The starting point is Article 2, Paragraph 4. All members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state or in any other manner inconsistent with the purposes of the United Nations. I do make my students memorize this. This is perhaps one of the most important provisions in the United Nations Charter. It sets forth a basic prohibition on the use of force or even the threat to use force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state. That's our starting point. Now, as with most legal agreements, there are exceptions. Two exceptions are contained in the UN Charter to this Article 2.4 prohibition. The first is that force in self-defense is permissible, and I'll talk a little bit about this in a minute. The second is that force authorized by the UN Security Council is permissible. So if the Security Council authorizes the use of force against North Korea or anybody else, that would be permissible under international law, under the United Nations Charter framework. Now, that's not going to happen, for everybody's information. That's not going to happen, so we don't even need to worry about that. The first exception, however, is the one that's relevant, and that is Article 51 says that states have an inherent right of individual and collective self-defense if an armed attack occurs. To be more precise, nothing in the present charter shall impair the inherent right of individual or collective self-defense if an armed attack occurs against a member of the United Nations until the Security Council has taken measures necessary to maintain international peace and security. Now, again, the Security Council is not going to act in this case. So the key points here are that states have an inherent right of individual or collective self-defense if an armed attack occurs. Now, what does that mean? Well, simply put, if the evil Canadians were to suddenly attack the United States and, you know, come in and try to take over Maine or something like that, the United States could use force in self-defense against the evil Canadians. It's a collective right so we could call upon the Mexicans to join us in fighting against the evil Canadians. Okay, that's clearly what it means. But there's a debate about whether preemptive self-defense is permissible under Article 51. Now, how can there be that debate? Well, there are three different ways. Again, we're going to do a little bit of law here. So there are three different schools of thought. There are three different interpretations of what Article 51 means and whether it would allow for the preemptive use of force. One school I've called the restrictionists. Second school we're going to call the counter-restrictionists. And the third school, because I lack creativity, I am calling the counter-restrictionist plus. And so at the end of this talk, if anybody comes up with a better name, let me know. So, the restrictionists. Now, not just Article 51, right? I've highlighted something. The restrictionists are going to say, okay, let's read Article 51. Nothing in the present charter shall impair the inherent right of individual collective self-defense if an armed attack occurs. Okay? So, the restrictionists are going to say, you cannot engage in the preemptive use of force. Why? What does it say there? If an armed attack occurs. Now, what's unclear about that? There are a number of public officials and scholars, a number of European scholars in particular, who are going to say this is the answer. You can't attack North Korea unless they hit you first. Period. End of story. Okay? But right? Look at the language. Well, same language, different things highlighted. Nothing in the present charter shall impair the inherent right of individual or collective self-defense if an armed attack occurs, etc. Another group of scholars, the counter-restrictionists, say, wait a minute. Article 51 doesn't say you can only use force if an armed attack occurs. It says there is an inherent right of self-defense, and of course nothing can prohibit you from exercising that if you've been attacked, but there is an inherent right. Now, if something is an inherent right, it means that this legal document isn't creating it. It was in existence prior to this legal document because it was an inherent right. The French version of this, which is equally authoritative, says droit naturel, a natural right. So the counter-restrictionists say, wait a minute. Article 51 was about acknowledging that you have an inherent right to self-defense. Okay, well, that's cool and fine and dandy, but what does that actually mean? In order to determine the meaning of this treaty provision that says there's an inherent right, you're going to have to look at what existed before the treaty. Correct? So you're going to have to look at pre-existing customary international law to determine what was the inherent right recognized under international law. So, I would note Justice Stephen Schwebel, American judge on the International Court of Justice in the Nicaragua case, sort of echoed this view. He's talking about Article 51 there at the bottom. He says, nothing in the present charter shall impair the inherent right of individual collective self-defense does not mean if and only if an armed attack occurs. So a justice on the International Court of Justice is affirming, for what it's worth, in a dissenting opinion, but nonetheless, is affirming that inherent right means more than just if an armed attack occurs. So if we've got to figure out what pre-existing customary international law is, we're going to have to look at the practice of states before 1945. And our starting point typically is the Caroline Incident. Now, the Caroline Incident occurred in 1837, and it was a bizarre occurrence. So, there was an insurrection going on in Canada, which automatically sounds bizarre. And, I mean, can you imagine the Canadians? And there was an American ship called the Caroline, owned by American citizens, that was moored on this side of the Niagara River, so the American side of the Niagara River. And the Caroline was allegedly involved in sending material and arms to the insurrectionists in Canada. Again, this is just preposterous, but this is 1837. So, late December, Canadian forces are irritated by this. And so Canadian forces dress all up in camo, whatever it looked like in the 1830s. They dress all up in camo. They stealthily cross the river. They board the Caroline. They set it on fire. They kill some people. And they send the ship over the Niagara Falls. Who knew? Who knew? Now, needless to say, the Americans were not happy with this. And so a series of discussions ensued between the British and the Americans. And Daniel Webster on the left here, looking very irritated about, I think he just generally looked like that, but looking very irritated about this, enters into an exchange of notes with Lord Ashburton of the United Kingdom. And the notes go back and forth about whether this was permissible or not and everything else. At the end of the day, the British apologize. Of course they do. They're good at that. But anyway, the British apologize. But that's not important. What is important is in the course of these interactions, Daniel Webster articulates two criteria for permissible preemptive use of force. Now, he's not making it up. He's saying this is what's recognized in the practice of states. This is what's recognized under customary international law. Two criteria, necessity and proportionality. Now, what is necessity? Webster says, if you're going to show what you did was permissible, it will be for that government to show a necessity of self-defense, instant, overwhelming, leaving no choice of means and no moment for deliberation. Meaning, if you're going to show it was legitimate to engage in the preemptive use of force, you're going to have to show that there was about to be an attack, that imminence existed, that there was going to be an attack momentarily and there was nothing you could do but take preemptive force. Necessity meant that you had to show that there was an imminent attack. Second, Webster said, you also are going to have to show that your response was proportionate and the threat. It will be for it, it's the government, it will be for it to show also that the local authorities of Canada, even supposing the necessity of the moment authorized them to enter the territories of the United States at all, did nothing unreasonable or excessive. So first, you have to show necessity, imminence of attack. Second, you have to show that your response was proportionate. So if you got, you know, a bunch of Americans using a ship to supply some arms, you know, the appropriate response would not be to launch a major land invasion of the United States. That would be disproportionate. So, the Caroline case articulated these two criteria of customary international law, which is accepted by the school of thought that I'm going to call counter-restrictionists. That yes, you can engage in the preemptive use of force, but you have to show necessity and your response has to be proportionate. You have to show that there's an imminent attack and that your response is proportionate to end the threat. Now, that was 1837. A lot of things have happened since 1837. So you're thinking to yourself, is that still, at least I'm thinking to myself, is that still customary international law? Well, I'm going to fast forward, you know, past the Civil War, World War I, World War II, and come to more recent events. If we're trying to assess state practice, what is recognized under customary international law, we're going to look at instances where there may have been discussion of preemptive force and other states have responded to it. Other states have commented on it. One place these kinds of commentary take place is in the United Nations Security Council. So let's just quickly run through some instances that have occurred. Cuban Missile Crisis. So in the Cuban Missile Crisis, there was a lot of debate. Matter of fact, having been at STRATCOM today, Curtis LeMay was actually advocating an attack directly on the territory of Cuba. There was a lot of discussion. Ultimately, President Kennedy imposed a quarantine, which was a blockade, which was still a use of force. And as the Security Council debated the legality of the actions, what we tended to see was a general acceptance of this idea that you could use force preemptively. Not everybody said it, and there was no resolution, but a general acceptance of this, provided it met the criteria of the Caroline case. Yes, 1962, they're quoting the Caroline case still. You had to show necessity and proportionality. Matter of fact, I think it was the Sierra Leonean delegate who brought up the Caroline case in the Cuban Missile Crisis. Well, a few years later, 1967 war, Egyptian and other Arab forces were mounting around the borders, peacekeepers were kicked out, and Israel attacked first. Israel attacked in advance of any attack from another state. Once again, the Security Council carried on this debate, and there was a lot of states saying Israel acted improperly, Israel acted properly, and so on. But once again, we saw the delegates to the Security Council generally echoing the Caroline framework and saying, yeah, this is probably the right framework. Now, there were some states that said there was no imminence, Israel shouldn't have acted. Other states saying, yes, it did have the right. So they disagreed on the facts, but the framework of necessity and proportionality was generally accepted. 1981, Israel bombs the Iraqi reactor at Osirik. Now, anybody here take Jean Kirkpatrick for a course? She was a great Georgetown professor, friend of mine. She, at the time, was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations under President Reagan. This came up before the Security Council, and what we found in the Security Council was, once again, an affirmation of the Caroline case, this idea that necessity and proportionality are required for the preemptive use of force. But the Security Council didn't think those criteria were met. In particular, the claim was, look, they haven't even put this reactor online, there's no indication it's going to produce nuclear weapons, and there's no indication that there's any imminence of attack. We're too far away, the claim was. So even the United States voted to condemn Israel in a Security Council resolution on the Osirik reactor. But what was significant, again, was this widespread acceptance of the Caroline case. Similarly, in the Iraq War of 2003, the United States did not base its argument on the right of preemptive self-defense, but it came up in discussion. And again, you saw the Security Council and a lot of members generally accepting this idea of the Caroline requirements. So, what would I say state practice was? At least as of 2003, I would say state practice tended to favor this counter-restrictionist approach. There tended to be an acceptance on the part of states that Article 51 talks about an inherent right, and that means the right established under customary international law, which means you can use force preemptively provided you have necessity, imminence, and your response is proportionate. Well, I said there were three schools of thought. Things got a little complicated, in large part after 9/11. In 2002, this other school of thought began to emerge. And it only really came from the United States, but the United States is a major actor in the international system, so not to be taken lightly. And it was expressed by both the Bush administration and the Obama administration. So we're not talking about, oh, this was just Bush or this was just Obama. Both administrations started to raise questions about a different counter-restrictionist approach. Remember, the restrictionists say you can never use force preemptively. Okay, they're poo-pooing that, obviously. But Bush and Obama suggest something else. In the National Security Strategy, which was promulgated by the Obama administration in 2002, and again, I apologize for all this text. I like the way they begin. For centuries, international law recognized that nations need not suffer an attack before they can lawfully take action to defend themselves against forces that present an imminent danger of attack. Isn't that what I just said? Okay, that is the counter-restrictionist approach. This is the United States acknowledging that it has existed for centuries. God bless you. If they would have stopped there, we would have ended the discussion right then. However, they keep going. Legal scholars and international jurists often condition the legitimacy of preemption on the existence of an imminent threat. I just said that, right? Okay, that's most often a visible mobilization of armies, navies, and air forces preparing to attack. Okay, if that slide were all they said, you would say, okay, the Bush administration has simply reiterated the counter-restrictionist approach. Mm-mm. But we must adapt the concept of imminent threat to the capabilities and objectives of today's adversaries. Rogue states and terrorists do not seek to attack us using conventional means. They know such attacks would fail. By the way, they actually do use those means too, but in any event, instead, they rely on acts of terror and potentially the use of weapons of mass destruction. Weapons that can be easily concealed, delivered covertly, and used without warning. So, see what the administration is saying. They're saying, we used to say customary law said that you had to have an imminent threat. Well, world's changed, technology's changed. We have rogue states, we got terrorists. Well, the U.S. has long maintained the option of preemptive action to counter a sufficient threat to our national security. The greater the threat, the greater the risk of inaction, and the more compelling the case for taking anticipatory action to defend ourselves, even if uncertainty remains as to the time and place of the enemy's attack. So they're already calling into question, maybe imminence, I don't know, maybe, you know, the world's really changed here. To forestall or prevent such hostile acts by our adversaries, the U.S. will, if necessary, act preemptively. So what the administration did, the Bush administration, is saying, you know, we've talked about imminence over the years, but I think we got to really relax that imminence criterion. We have terrorists, we got rogue states, so maybe we need not insist like we would traditionally on the imminence of an attack. Now, it wasn't just the Bush administration. Eric Holder, Attorney General, gave a speech on March 5th, 2012, and he says, the evaluation of whether an individual presents an imminent threat incorporates considerations of the relevant window of opportunity to act. The possible harm that missing that window would cause to... So this sounds like the learned hand test for those who studied law. The possible harm that missing the window would cause to civilians and the likelihood of heading off future disastrous attacks against the United States. So he's saying, okay, the Bush administration said we might need to relax the concept of imminence. We might need to redefine what imminence means. As we learned on 9/11, Al-Qaeda demonstrated the ability to strike with little or no notice and to cause devastating casualties. Its leaders are continually planning attacks against the United States, and they do not behave like a traditional military wearing uniforms, carrying arms openly, or massing forces in preparation for an attack. The world's different. We got to think about imminence differently. Given these facts, the Constitution does not require the president to delay action until some theoretical end stage of planning. Imminence would have suggested that you were supposed to defer until that point, when the precise time, place, and manner of an attack become clear. Such requirement would create an unacceptably high risk to our efforts, that our efforts would fail, and that Americans would be killed. So Holder is saying, look, we agree with the Bush administration. The world has fundamentally changed. It can't be one of these situations where we wait for these armies to mass at the border and it becomes clear that there's an imminent attack to act. We have to be able to think about it on a case-by-case basis and then decide what we're going to do. That's a long line. Right before President Obama left office in December of 2016, he issued something called the Obama Legal Policy Framework. And it reiterated this. When considering whether an armed attack is imminent under the jus ad bellum, which is the law relating to the recourse to force, for purposes of the initial use of force against another state or on its territory, the United States analyzes a variety of factors. These factors include the nature and immediacy of the threat, the probability of an attack, whether the anticipated attack is part of a concerted pattern of continuing armed activity, the likely scale of the attack, and the injury, loss, or damage likely to result therefrom. It sounds very legalistic. In the absence of mitigating action, and the likelihood that there will be other opportunities to undertake effective action, self-defense, that may be expected to cause less serious collateral injury, loss, or damage. That's, again, a lot of text there. But see what's going on there. They're saying, you know, it's so complex. We can't just say we're going to act if there's an imminent attack. We've got to look at all the circumstances. We've got to evaluate it based on everything that's going on. And so the absence of specific evidence where an attack will take place or the precise nature of an attack, which is what you would need previously for imminence, does not preclude a conclusion that an armed attack is imminent for purposes of the exercise of the right of self-defense, provided that there is a reasonable and objective basis for concluding that an armed attack is imminent. But there's really a bunch of lawyers worked on this. Finally, as is now increasingly recognized by the international community, the traditional conception of what constitutes an imminent attack must be understood in light of modern-day capabilities, techniques, technological innovations of terrorist organizations. Now, again, that's a lot of text, but what you saw happening was the Bush administration saying the world's different, we have to relax our understanding of imminence. Obama administration comes in and says we have to redefine imminence. And we have to define it on a case-by-case basis looking at all these factors. And the idea that previously existed that the troops were on the border getting ready to go and we knew an attack was about to take place doesn't work anymore. Now, where does that leave us? Summarize. We have three basic interpretations, schools of thought on the preemptive use of force. Restrictionists just say no. That's it, no. Why? It's as if an armed attack occurs under Article 51. No preemptive use of force, period. The traditional counter-restrictionists say you can use force preemptively. You need to meet the criteria of necessity, meaning there's an imminent attack, and your response has to be proportionate. The newer counter-restrictionists plus say we have to relax the imminence requirement, but they don't really give us an alternative. They say we just have to look at it on a case-by-case basis. And for those of you who are lawyers in this room, that's not really what you want to hear when somebody's trying to give you legal interpretation. So what does this provision of the contract mean? Oh, I don't know. You got to look at it on a case-by-case. That's not a good answer to that question. Or what does this section of the federal statute mean? I don't know. You got to look at it in all the issues that come up on a case-by-case. That's not really good. And it also is not good from the standpoint of signaling to others when you believe a preemptive use of force was lawful and when it won't be. So we have those three schools of thought. Quick evaluation. This is sort of now, and I apologize for this, it's going to be my legal judgment, my legal evaluation of which of these I think reflects existing customary law. First one, no. I don't think the restrictionist interpretation accurately reflects customary law. There are a number of scholars who would disagree, but I think they're in a minority. Two, I think that's actually where we are. I think if you look at most of the world and most of public officials throughout the world, they would say we're still in category two. That's when the preemptive use of force would be permissible if you could show an imminent attack. Third category, most other scholars are going to say, this is just the U.S. The U.S. is really pushing this further and further, but most have responded by saying, we don't accept it. We don't yet support it. Again, this is just my judgment. I would say probably two reflects existing customary law. Now, we were talking about North Korea, weren't we? It may not have seemed like it, but we were talking about North Korea. If we apply this framework to understanding what's going on with Kim Jong-un, where do we go? Okay. The restrictionists, the answer is simple. You can't use force against North Korea unless they actually strike first. So if bombs or perhaps even cartridges that are empty of bombs start falling on people's territory, if bombs start exploding, then you can respond in self-defense. The traditional counter-restrictionists are going to say there has to be indication of an imminence of an attack. There has to be indication that Kim Jong-un is really about to light one off, that something is about to happen, and if we don't act, it will. What's interesting on that one is I got a call from a journalist a number of weeks ago, and we were talking about this framework, and the journalist said to me, and I just said to the journalist what I just said to you, and the journalist said, okay, do you think we're there yet? Are we at a point where a threat is imminent? And what I said was, no, I don't think we're there yet. Interestingly enough, over the next couple hours, I'm not kidding, Kim Jong-un says a lot of more things and started to describe what might happen in Guam in great detail. And a friend of mine then read this article in the New York Times and said, do you still believe that? And I said, the guy called me 11 o'clock in the morning. It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon. A lot's happened between then and now. But I still don't think we're there yet. I do not think that we're at the point of an imminent attack. Now, I was asked this question yesterday at Stratcom. Same question. Do you think we're... And I said, I think we would know. And part of me saying how we would know involved me saying, I have to put it in this context. I don't have access to classified material. I don't have access to signals intelligence. I don't have access to photographic intelligence. But I think from the standpoint of the American military, there would be enough indicators that it wasn't just going to be a test, that it wasn't just going to be a launch, that defensive mechanisms were being positioned in a particular way so that we would know it was happening. Now, because I don't have access to all those things, for all I know, since the time Michelle drove me over here, it's happened this afternoon, but I don't think we're there, and I hope to God we're not there yet. And I continue to believe that to be the case. Now, if you're in the third category, if you believe that that's the law, then you can do it. Because you could make an argument that Kim Jong-un has made enough bellicose statements, that he's so unpredictable, that if we strike preemptively, it may give us the upper hand. And those were all the things that, that's why I gave you all that text. Those are the kinds of things that Holder was suggesting. Those are the kind of things that the Obama legal framework was suggesting. If you put it in all that context, then maybe it would be lawful to act. My conclusion, number two is the proper interpretation of customary international law. There is no imminence of attack right now, as of a couple hours ago anyway. I do not think it would be lawful. Questions? Yes, sir. Which do I think would lead to greater world peace? I mean, I certainly don't. I think three is highly dangerous because it is extraordinarily subjective, because it's me perceiving that something's going to happen. Now, there's a little bit of that in two, but the idea is that in theory, two is a little more objective. Three is basically saying if you feel threatened. Matter of fact, the reporter that was asking me about this then said to me, do you think Kim Jong-un could launch a preemptive strike? Because remarks made about fire and fury and a variety of other things, if you're in category two, you would justify it on that basis as well. So I think three is destructive. I think one would be conducive of world order if the United Nations security system functioned. In other words, if the United Nations Security Council actually functioned and worked and something happened, the Security Council could meet and then could respond and advance itself. If that would be great. But that's not the case. So I think two reflects existing customary international law. I think given the world circumstances right now, it's also the one most conducive to world order. Yes, ma'am.
You focused your entire lecture on necessity, but you left out proportionality, which is a key part of just war theory.
So let me answer it. So proportionality would simply mean that, so the question I was really approaching was whether we could engage preemptively, and the proportionality would mean if we've determined that we can, our response would have to be proportionate to end the threat. And so we'd have to look at exactly what was happening, what the strike was potentially going to involve. But absolutely, that has to be brought into it as well.
Well, I think with nuclear weapons, you've changed the conditions entirely here, because the whole idea of nuclear weapons is that they're positioned around the country and would survive a first strike. Anything we tried to do in any sort of imminent way or preventive way to try to shut down any kind of nuclear launch on the part of Kim Jong-un, he's going to have some held in reserve. I
don't know that. And that would be something that would have to be, I mean, I agree.
Right.
That would have to be in the calculations.
We know that. That's the only logical path for him to take. So if you're going to talk about whether or not we could actually see an imminent threat, and the proportionality part of this is equally important. In fact, under the preventionist theory, your counter-restrictionist plus, proportionality is all you have left. But nuclear weapons are so destructive that there's no real proportional response here. If they attack us, if we attack them, they're going to attack us back. And then you're talking about lives lost out of all proportion to what was gained.
So absolutely, I agree 100%. But what I would say, though, is that is assuming that... Now, I'm not advocating a preemptive use of force. Let me begin by saying that. That is assuming that that would figure into the calculation. To say you have a right to use force because you think something is imminent is one thing. Your response has to be proportionate. But you sure as anything better know what the likelihood is of a response and what kind of weapons they have. You absolutely need to know that. I don't have the intelligence, I've been accused of that a number of times, but I don't have the intelligence to know whether there's even a deliverable system right now. We seem to know that there's an ICBM. They seem to indicate that there has been a detonation of a thermonuclear device. I don't know what else they have, and I don't know what else they could use, and I don't know what they could deliver. In any legal and policy evaluation, you would have to say, first of all, let's go to the second category. You would have to say, okay, is there an imminent of an attack? That's one thing. But then you'd have to ask yourself, what's going to happen if we preempt? Are we going to be able to prevent a nuclear attack by preempting, or are we going to cause a nuclear attack by preempting? One of the reasons the Israelis launched so early on the Osirik reactor was because they claimed that if we don't act now, by the time there would be something imminent, it would be too late. Some have speculated that prior to the 1994 agreed framework with North Korea, that there might have been a time to do something preemptively there. So I agree with you 100%.
And a preventive attack on North Korea is still illegal under Application 2 or Application 3?
Maybe. We'd have to assess that. We'd absolutely have to assess that. Personally, I can't, and again, speaking from a policy perspective, I can't see a circumstance where a preemptive strike against North Korea doesn't cause a major invasion into the South, shelling of Seoul. I can't see a circumstance where that wouldn't happen. Okay. But the people who are going to have to make the decision are going to have to make that assessment. So I agree with you 100%. 100%. Yes, sir.
This may kind of open somewhat of a can of worms, but I'm just going to kind of go ahead with it anyway. Looking at these interpretations, Interpretation 2 and Interpretation 3, in particular 3, as it's been promulgated here and with the Bush and Obama administration, my question is, should varying presidential administrations have the legal standing to decide for themselves like what rules they're going to use to dictate preeminent attacks? Because it seems to me that we've gotten to the point from the Bush to the Obama administration where you have these drone strikes and the Pentagon doesn't seem to even know, you know, the people that they're throwing missiles at. Like they're basing their attacks on, you know, the fact that the guy might have been bin Laden because he was tall and such like that. And obviously that's not happening regularly, but my point is that we seem to be going toward an era where the government or the kind of the presidential administration could just decide willy-nilly when to throw missiles at people and when not to, and kind of the root of that seems to be this loosening of imminence in the decision-making for preeminent strikes. So what's the legal framework, I guess I would ask, for restraining that, for taking back in our interpretation from the non-restrictionist plus back to number two? Because it seems to me that that's something that needs to happen relatively soon.
So you have raised a really important point that touches on constitutional law. So here's the dilemma that we have. Under Article 1 of the Constitution, Congress declares war. Also, Congress has the authority to make rules concerning capture. Note that. Congress has the authority to make rules concerning capture on land and sea. It's Article 1 of the Constitution. Article 2 of the Constitution, the president is the commander-in-chief. Now, what do these two different rules mean? That's where the debate ensues. So Congress could clearly legislate on a lot of things, and Congress has. Congress has enacted the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which imposes a lot of regulations on the military. Congress, or at least the Senate, gives advice and consent to treaties like the Geneva Conventions, which impose certain restrictions, and so on. Congress presumably could say some things about this area as well. Now, I don't need to have a long discourse on how well Congress is doing these things, but Congress could. Even if Congress did, the president would say, I am the commander-in-chief. That's got to mean that I have the right to use operational control over the military. So you can't constrain me so that I cannot effectively fight. Okay, that's the debate, and there are people on both sides of the question. Now you may say, well, wait a minute, we live in a country where there's a court. Problem is, the courts never decide these issues. What tends to happen in these cases, and suits have been brought all the time. So for example, when President Clinton launched the operation in connection with the Kosovo conflict, Congressman Tom Campbell brought suit and said Congress hasn't authorized this. The courts found that the case was non-justiciable. And that happens time and time again. Courts either find that nobody has standing to sue, that the case is not ripe, or that it presents a non-justiciable political question. So here's the dilemma we have, is that Congress has rights, the president has a right, courts aren't going to resolve it, and so the only effective way, I think, would be for Congress to try to rein in the president through legislation. But I'll give you an example, War Powers Resolution that was adopted after the Vietnam War. That purports to restrict the president's authority, yet every president since has claimed it's unconstitutional, and Congress has never really invoked it. So where I'm going with this is, along with the way, the default is going to be that the executive branch is going to make claims about its authority to use force, and absent clear congressional restraints, those claims are going to go unchecked. And to quote Justice Frankfurter from the Steele seizure case, this executive power asserted in this way is going to write a gloss on the Constitution, creating the notion that the president can, in fact, do that. Yes, sir.
I teach political science at Creighton, and I've been to North Korea, South Korea, Japan, and I'm here in the United States. This is a great talk. It's timely, but the wrong place, unfortunately. If you talk in this subject in North Korea, South Korea, Japan, even China, will be more appropriately. I don't think...
They might not let me into some of those places, but in any event...
Anyway, I think that as the United States, the most powerful military country in the world, we're talking about North Korea as an imminent threat to North Koreans. They laugh. And I ask them if they think that they are in the position that, you know, retaliated by the United States. They say, no, we try to survive. We try to survive. We're not posing any threat to any country. They do to China, and they do to South Korea and Japan, but I don't think they do to the United States, unfortunately. I think if we can broaden our eyes in this spectrum and thinking about the North Koreans' intention to, you know, arm itself with nuclear weapons, it will make things much easier to understand why they do so. And I just hope that there is an alternative way to approach to this North Korean nuclear disastrous, unfortunately. Thank you very much. Anyway, I enjoy your talk.
Thank
very
you.
Much.
Let me appreciate that. Let me note, the very beginning, the one thing I said I wasn't talking about was the ethics of the policy. And I can share with you my views on the policy, certainly. And as I think understanding the law is important. And I think it's especially important because the idea of preemption has been thrown back and forth. And what I would want to say to somebody is, look, legally, I don't think you have a right, the U.S. has a right to use preemptive force now. I don't think you do, because I don't think imminence is met. Even if imminence were met, then you'd have to go into the question about, okay, well, what would a response mean, and would we be able to maintain proportionality? Absolutely. That's a legal question. And I think it's important that people understand that, because law has policy implications. If you do something which is going to be broadly perceived as illegal, that's problematic. I think from a policy perspective, and this has been a series of conversations I've been participating in, and this is my view. We have to accept the fact that North Korea is a nuclear weapons state. We may not like that. It may have been something that could have been prevented 20 or 30 years ago. It cannot be prevented now, period. I think we need to acknowledge that. I'm not happy to say that, but I think we need to acknowledge that. Just as we have over the years with Pakistan, India, Israel, a bunch of other states. We have to acknowledge that. We have to begin negotiations not trying to denuclearize Korea. That's not going to happen. It is so vital for North Korea's regime survival that they have that status. We need to begin by recognizing that. So that's the first thing. Second, I think we need to begin talks with North Korea and involve South Korea and China and look at creating some kind of an arrangement, some kind of condominium, which would provide some security assurances, provide some kind of regulation, provide assurances from us that we're not going to attack them, and so on. Even remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. The Kennedy administration promised not to attack Cuba. That was actually part of that whole deal. And I think we need to see about mechanisms we can do to improve the economic status of North Korea. I think we need to do those things. That may not be attractive, but I think we need to do those things. We need to de-escalate the conflict. We cannot wish away North Korean nuclear weapons. We cannot create an alternative situation. Sanctions aren't going to work. And I feel this is what we need to do. And I would actually hope that we could be moving forward in that direction. So I think we may agree on that. And while we're thinking about that, we also need to understand what the law says. Dave, I turn it back to you. Thank you. Thank you, guys.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Anthony Arend, professor of government and foreign service, and senior associate dean for graduate and faculty affairs in the Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. He spoke on the topic North Korea and the preemptive use of force. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday afternoon, September 8th, 2017, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, and Dave Summers, Executive Director of the Omaha Bar Association, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.